Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2009 and Ruination, the early years.
Imagine, like, walking into a family holiday party.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
But, I mean, I'm not talking about the perfectly curated, you know, matching sweater kind of gathering.
Right, definitely not the ones you see plastered across, like, a holiday lifestyle catalog.
Yeah, or a really polished Instagram grid.
Because the reality of, you know, actual human gathering is usually much, much messier than that pristine image.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So picture a party where the spiked eggnog ran completely dry, like about an hour ago.
Uh-oh.
And all the polite, formal social filters have just completely vanished.
Oh, those are the best parties, honestly.
Right. Everyone is just simply sitting around the living room, happily trading their absolute most embarrassing, unvarnished stories from the year.
And somehow, despite the absolute chaos, or, well, maybe because of it, it feels completely perfect. It feels authentic.
That is exactly the energy we are walking into today. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
And we want to welcome you to Ruination, the early years.
We are so glad you're here with us.
Today, we are taking a deep dive into a really fascinating stack of primary sources. We've got actual daily audio recordings, archived listener correspondence, and the raw show notes.
All specifically from December 2009 in the Big Fatty Online or BFO universe.
Yes, exactly. And our mission for this deep dive is to explore a month that is, well, it's entirely defined by explosive holiday joy, messy real-world collisions, and honestly, a really poignant reflection on digital survival.
Right, because we are going to look at how Big Fatty completely transforms his daily audio journal into this chaotic holiday hub for what he calls the crema season.
The crema season, I love that term.
It's so good. We're going to dig into the bizarre physical mail he receives and follow him through this exhausting gauntlet of real-world social events.
And really unpack exactly how he manages to thrive and build this incredible community while, you know, an entire generation of early podcasters are just burning out and giving up all around him.
It's a really unique time capsule. And to really understand the specific era of the BFO universe, we kind of have to start by looking at his physical environment.
Right, the Fat Cave.
Yes, the Fat Cave, which is his affectionate term for his home base and recording studio.
It's a great name.
During December 2009, the strictly digital world of his broadcast starts aggressively bleeding into his physical space.
And based on these audio logs, that bleeding happens almost entirely through the postal service, doesn't it?
Precisely. It happens through what the community calls crema cards, which is their version of Christmas cards.
Okay, got it.
And he becomes absolutely obsessed with receiving these physical items from the community. If you listen to the source audio, he literally painstakingly opens these envelopes live on the air.
Wait, like he just sits there and tears paper into the microphone?
Yes, and he is verbally tracking every single speck of glitter that falls out, every strip of foil, every single texture.
Oh, wow. And just looking at the inventory of what was sent, the community completely leans into the madness.
Oh, they totally do.
Because it sounds like these aren't just your standard store-bought greeting cards that you pick up at the pharmacy.
Not at all. The level of effort and specificity is honestly staggering. For instance, there's a listener named Don in Utah.
Okay.
And he sends this card that features a mechanical element. It's a dog physically jumping up and down trying to reach a piece of bacon.
I mean, that is incredibly specific to his brand.
It really is. And then it just escalates from there. There's a listener named Steven in the UK who sends what is essentially a rigged booby-trapped card.
A booby-trapped card?
Yeah. So when Big Fatty opens it on the microphone, it shoots these little paper snowflakes all over his floor.
Oh, my God.
And Big Fatty, hilariously and repeatedly, dubs these paper scraps suffs.
The suffs.
Suffs. He spends significant airtime just staring at his floor, complaining to the audience about the suffs getting absolutely everywhere.
So the listener is literally just subjected to the audio of a man wrestling with increasingly unhinged packages and complaining about his messy floor.
Exactly. That is the content.
That's amazing.
And the physical items perfectly mirror the show's deeply entrenched inside jokes. We see this peak with a massive care package from a listener named Mr. B.
Ah, yes. Out in what Big Fatty refers to as the Laguna Beaches.
Yes, the Laguna Beaches.
Okay, I read the inventory list for this specific care package in the notes, and it reads like an absolute fever dream.
It really does.
Can you walk us through what was actually in this box?
Oh, it is pure unfiltered madness. So the package contains an optical illusion of Elvis Presley.
Naturally.
It has a sheet of Peter Pan hotel stickers. It includes a pack of temporary tattoos featuring dragons and Nordic men.
Wait, dragons and Nordic men?
Yep, very specific aesthetic there.
Wow, okay.
There is also a thick stack of fake novelty money
and
the pièce de résistance, a singing pooping pig.
I'm sorry, a toy pig that sings and poops.
Yes, a plastic toy pig. And he naturally struggles to operate it live on the microphone, providing this incredible audio of him just fighting with a piece of plastic.
Oh my word, I can only imagine what that sounded like.
It's hilarious. And the bizarre mail just keeps coming. A listener named Peter G. in the Oaklands sends an entire book completely dedicated to the subject of bacon.
More bacon.
Always more bacon. And then Julie in North Kakalaki sends a Publix supermarket gift card.
Okay, that's actually practical.
Well, specifically so he can, in his words, eat high on the hog, which in the BFO universe specifically means buying Oscar Mayer bacon.
Right, of course. And he actually reciprocates this, right? The sources show he offers his own custom 2009 commemorative Crema cards to anyone who writes in.
Yeah, complete with a special Christmas happy tucked inside.
But I have to stop and push back on the underlying logic here for a second.
Okay, go for it.
I'm really trying to wrap my head around the mechanism of this community. Why is an audience of fully grown adults spending their actual hard-earned money and paying international postage to mail a man a singing, pooping pig and bacon-themed literature?
It does seem a bit strange at first glance.
It feels like this bizarre reverse Santa's workshop, where the gifts are intentionally annoying. What is the psychology behind this?
That is the crucial question, really. To understand the why, you have to view this through the lens of early internet culture.
Okay.
In 2009, we didn't have the frictionless instant gratification of modern social media algorithms. Mailing a physical object was the ultimate flex of intimacy.
Right, because it requires real, tangible effort.
Exactly. What you might call a physical proof of work.
Ah, like using physical friction to prove the authenticity of a digital friendship.
Precisely. You have to hunt down a bizarre item, find a box, write a label, go to the post office, and actually pay for shipping.
That's a lot of steps just for a joke.
It is. This community isn't trying to send polished, sentimental gifts because, well, that would be boring audio. They're communicating through shared performative nuisance. The mess is the message.
Performative nuisance, that perfectly captures it.
Right. By sending an exploding snowflake card that ruins his floor, they are proving that their bond transcends the digital space.
They are physically invading his reality with their shared inside jokes.
Exactly. It's a tangible manifestation of their loyalty.
Okay, that makes total sense. So we have this digital community invading his physical sanctuary, the Fat Cave. But the sources also show that December isn't just about him sitting inside opening mail.
No, definitely not.
Because if all this energy is coming into his home, what happens when he actually has to step out of that insulated environment and navigate the real world?
That is where the narrative tension of December really kicks in. The digital sanctuary gives way to the absolute exhaustion of physical socializing.
The holiday party gauntlet.
Yes. He provides these incredibly vivid play-by-play recaps of local holiday parties.
And the details he chooses to focus on are so mundane, yet so descriptive. Like, what kind of events is he documenting?
Well, he attends the horror group potluck party. And instead of talking about, like, deep conversations or whatever, he meticulously lists off the menu for the audience.
Of course he does. What was on the menu?
Ham and turkey sandwiches, a really heavy 7-layer dip, artichoke balls, and, of course, his own infamous homemade sausage balls.
Which, again, leads right into that unvarnished, authentic aesthetic.
I'm not.
It's not champagne and caviar.
No, it's heavy dips and cold cuts.
I love it.
And he is relentlessly documenting his social calendar with recurring real-world characters. He recounts an outing to a local establishment called Cock-a-Doodle-Doo's,
which he cheekily refers to on air as the Underpants Express or BJ Roosters, right?
Yes. He goes there with friends the audience knows intimately, people like Terminally Single Tim, Wes, the gay country boy, and Frank from Atlanta, who actually brought along a new beau.
So he's basically treating his real life like a cast of characters for the show. But how does his actual day job fit into this. He works a corporate job at this time, right?
He does, and he cynically refers to it on the show as the coal mine.
The coal mine. That's a mood.
Right. And the climax of his real-world holiday socializing happens at the coal mine's retirement and crema party.
Okay.
Which is held at this local membership club. And this is where a deeply messy, almost heartbreaking tragedy strikes.
Oh, no. What happens?
He takes a large, lovingly prepared Ziploc bag of his homemade Chex mix, which is his phonetic spin on Chex mix, into the office.
A sacred holiday snack.
By highly labor-intensive snack.
Oh, boy.
And the bag catastrophically fails. He spills the entire batch of Chex mix all over the corporate office floor.
Oh, the devastation. I can actually feel the pain of that.
I know. But this exhaustion, you know, balancing the coal mine, the spilled snacks, the local bars, it actually causes the podcast format itself to break down in real time.
Wait, really? It breaks the format?
It does. And this results in an incredible piece of audio history. He actively records one specific broadcast in what we can only call a split state.
Have you ever heard of a host doing this before? Because I haven't. From the notes, it sounds completely unhinged.
It is extremely rare. Let me walk you through how this split state recording actually functions.
Please do.
So he starts recording the episode completely sober. He gets through the first half of the show, right up through playing the listener voicemail letters.
Normal show so far.
Exactly. Then he physically stops recording, goes out to the coal mine holiday party, and then comes back hours later to record the second half of the exact same episode.
And he doesn't try to hide this gap in time from the listener. Like, he doesn't just pretend it's all one cohesive take.
Not at all. He explicitly warns the audience about the severe tonal shift they are about to experience.
Oh, that's hilarious.
He admits that at the party, he upgraded from his usual Tango, his nickname for Tanqueray Gintu Top Shelf Bombay Sapphire.
Oh, boy. The Bombay Sapphire.
Yeah, and when that second half of the recording kicks in, the Bombay Sapphire has clearly taken hold. He is heavily, undeniably slurring his words.
Okay, I have to jump in here with some serious skepticism.
Go ahead.
Because I am struggling with the logic of this content strategy.
How so?
Well, if you are running a digital broadcast in 2009 with a global audience, you know, people listening in the UK and Australia, all over the world, why dedicate so much premium airtime to heavily slurred, hyper-local inside jokes?
It's a fair question.
Right. If I am listening from London, why do I care about a spilled bag of homemade Chex mix on a specific corporate floor in America?
Mm.
Doesn't leaning into this messy hyper-local content usually kill a global audience?
That is a brilliant question, and it gets to the absolute core of why the BFO universe survived when others failed.
Really?
Yes. Conventional media logic says, yes, hyper-local content alienates a broad audience. But in the emerging digital landscape of 2009, it achieved the exact opposite.
Oh, interesting.
By giving a highly vulnerable, completely unedited play-by-play of his local life, he invites you, the global listener, to be the ultimate insider.
So he is basically bypassing traditional broadcasting rules entirely.
Completely. He is essentially serializing his own life into a daily sitcom.
I see.
You don't need to be standing in the coal mine to relate to the universal sinking horror of dropping your absolute favorite labor-intensive snack on the floor in front of your judgmental coworkers.
Yeah, that translates anywhere.
Exactly. You don't need to live in his town to understand the bone-deep exhaustion of attending forced corporate holiday parties.
Ah, I see. The spilled Chex mix isn't just a local event. It's a universal symbol of trying your best and having things fall apart anyway.
Precisely. By refusing to edit out the slurring or the spilled snacks or the complaints about paper snowflakes on his floor, he builds an unbreakable foundation of trust.
Wow.
He takes the hyperlocal and makes it completely universal through sheer vulnerability.
That completely flips my perspective on it. It really does. So after the Bombay Sapphire hangover's clear and the holiday parties finally wrap up, yep, the month closes with Big Fatty doing some serious reflection.
Yes, the end of the year always brings that out.
The sources show him looking back on his own longevity and the overall state of the podcasting industry at the end of 2009. What exactly is the climate for digital creators at this time?
Honestly, it is a brutal landscape. Yeah, but his period of reflection actually begins with a massive, unexpected wave of industry validation. He discovers that the BFO has been nominated for a prestigious podcast award in the GBT category.
Oh, the gay, bi, and trans category, which is a huge deal for an independent creator.
She's huge.
But knowing Big Fatty's brand, I'm guessing he doesn't handle the prestige with total reverence.
Definitely not. In true Big Fatty fashion, he immediately and irreverently rebrands the GBT category for his audience.
What does he call it?
He tells them it actually stands for the Gigantic Bouncing Testicles category.
Oh my goodness. Of course he does.
It is the perfect defense mechanism against taking himself or the industry too seriously.
Right. Does he end up winning?
Ultimately, no. He loses the award to a massive, highly produced institutional juggernaut called Feast of Fun.
Oh, that's a shame.
But what's fascinating is how he reacts to the loss. He doesn't wallow.
Yeah.
He uses that exact moment on the microphone to declare that the awards don't matter at all.
Oh, that's nice.
His daily listeners, you know, the people taking the time to send the pooping pigs and call the voicemail line, they are the real prize.
And he desperately needs that loyal listener base because from what I'm seeing in the research, 2009 was not a kind year to early digital creators.
No, it was rough.
He explicitly refers to 2009 on the broadcast as the year of quitting.
It was an era of massive, unprecedented burnout. Keep in mind, this is before massive monetization, before Patreon, before podcasting was a lucrative career path.
Right. People were just doing this for free in their living rooms.
Exactly. It was a labor of love, and the labor was really catching up to people. He highlights other podcasters to make his point. For example, he mentions a creator he refers to as the Sea Hag, or Vera, who takes a sudden, unexpected hiatus from her show.
What happens to her?
She just disappears. Her website simply posts what Big Fatty playfully misreads as an impotent message. He means important message, stating simply that life happened.
Just life happened.
Yeah. And that was the reality. People are just pod fading. The pressure to create polished, weekly, important content was crushing them, and they were disappearing from the internet entirely.
But Big Fatty doesn't quit. In fact, right before the year ends, on December 30th, he hits a hyper-specific, almost baffling life milestone.
Oh, the 19,500 days.
Yes. Thanks to a new app he downloaded on his iPhone, he joyously announces to the audience that he has turned exactly 19,500 days old.
And if you listen to the tape, he is incredibly proud of that number. It is a genuine celebration for him.
I have to admit, I find this fascinating, but I also have to challenge the metric.
Why is that?
Well, it seems obsessively granular, almost absurd, to count your life in individual days rather than years. Why focus on such a weird, specific number like 19,500 days? Why not just celebrate a birthday?
I get why that sounds strange, but that granular counting connects directly to the core mechanism of his survival strategy.
How so?
Think about the creators who are burning out, the ones striving to produce highly polished, highly edited weekly content. Big Fatty isn't doing that. He is operating on a grueling, relentless daily format.
Right. He is recording every single day, whether he has something profound to say or not.
Exactly. By choosing to count his life in individual days, he is validating the mundane daily grind. The day itself becomes the achievement.
Yeah.
He survives the year of quitting precisely because he doesn't strive for pristine audio perfection. He finds profound meaning and momentum in simply showing up.
Wow. So even if his only contribution on a Tuesday is to complain about a broken soda stream or to sigh heavily while sweeping glitter stuffs off his floor, that is still a victory because he documented the day.
You nailed it. The consistency of the day is the triumph. He isn't trying to create a masterpiece. He is trying to create a companion for his listeners.
And in doing so, he builds a community that is completely immune to the burnout taking down the rest of the industry. That is such a powerful way to look at content creation. Showing up in all your messy reality is the content. Well, as we wrap up this deep dive into the source material, what is the ultimate takeaway for our listeners today? How do we apply this 2009 time capsule to our lives now?
I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to ponder off air.
All right, let's hear it.
We live in a modern digital era that is utterly obsessed with curating flawless highlight reels.
Oh, absolutely.
We use filters to hide our messy floors, we edit out our stumbles, and we try to present a pristine version of our lives. But looking back at the fierce, tangible loyalty that Big Fatty commanded in December 2009, a loyalty that manifested in explosive snowflakes and shared exhaustion, we really have to ask ourselves a difficult question.
Okay.
Are we actually engineering away our own ability to truly connect?
Oof, that hits hard. By hiding the mess, we hide the humanity.
Exactly. What deep, lifelong communities are we entirely missing out on today by refusing to share our own spilled Chex Mix and our own unvarnished realities with the world?
That is an incredible question to chew on. Sometimes the absolute mess is exactly what brings us together in the first place.
It really is.
Well, thank you so much for joining us at the table today and unpacking this amazing audio history. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
We invite you to come back next Saturday for another month of Ruination, the early years.
And please remember to tune in each Sunday for a Ruination Repeat, which recaps last week's current BFO episodes.
Thank you so much for pulling up a chair and taking this deep dive into the archives with us. We'll see you next time.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination the Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.